Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
This podcast is brought to you by Wise, the app that makes using different currencies easy. With Wise, you can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate. There are no hidden fees either. See exactly what you'll pay up front, every time. Join 16 million customers already saving with Wise. To learn how Wise could work for you, download the app or visit wise.com.
I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast. We're in Chicago for a passing of the torch at the Democratic National Convention. Joe Biden has urged Americans to elect Kamala Harris as his replacement. But what will President Biden do with the time he has left in office? And what is the legacy he wants to leave? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there. Welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. My name is Ed Butler. On this edition, we're assessing why Ghana is going big on refining its own crude oil, despite protests from local residents. There's the record-breaking video game that's swashbuckling its way out of China this month, and how Chile is bouncing back in bloom after a year of deadly forest fires.
My uncle worked here for 45 years. He worked in the French Gardens, where we're going to use our expertise to help replant and to make it a showcase garden.
More from Chile's gardens coming up later in the programme. First, though, you may remember for some time now how European leaders have been demanding that China cut the levels of subsidies that it's giving its electric car makers. Cut or else.
Global markets are now flooded with cheaper Chinese electric cars. And their price is kept artificially low by huge state subsidies. This is distorting our market. And as we do not accept this distortion from the inside in our market, we do not accept this from the outside. So I can announce today that the Commission is launching an anti-subsidy investigation into electric vehicles coming from China.
The words there of the EU Commission Chief Ursula von der Leyen speaking in September last year. In July, that investigation concluded. They announced swinging tariffs on all Chinese EVs entering Europe. And now they revised some of those rates, lowering duties on certain brands. Tesla electric vehicles, for instance. Not others, though. To explain exactly how all of this is going to work and really what's going on, I'm joined by Finbar Birmingham. He's the Brussels correspondent for the South China Morning Post. Hi, Finbar. Thanks for joining us. Set this out for us, will you? Tesla's tariffs to be set at 19% now.
That's right. So across the board, you've got a base rate of 10%. That is the standard import duty that any electric vehicle from China has to pay. Tesla previously was lumped in with many of the other automakers in China, and they had a tariff rate, a provisional tariff rate of 20.8%. But having appealed to the European Commission and asked for their own individual investigation, Tesla now finds itself in a fortunate position to be paying the lowest rate of any car maker that's present in China, because it was willing to turn over its books to the European Commission, and it was able to show that it had received subsidies in China from the Chinese government, but that they were lower than the level of subsidies that had been received by the other firms who'd been sampled, which were all Chinese-owned companies.
So it's equivalent to turning yourself in and collaborating with the authorities here, really. That's kind of why they're being kind of given time off for good behaviour sort of thing.
In a way, and that option is available to European car makers as well. But funnily enough, none of them have been willing to go through with that. They've not applied for a different rate. And the suspicion is that perhaps they've been getting fat off Chinese state subsidies, and it probably wouldn't look too good if it was to come out in the open.
Right. Are you referring to, for instance, that VW, which of course has a big operation inside of China?
All of them, VW, BMW, you know, all of these big Chinese Mercedes-Benz, all these big Chinese, German companies are very present in China. They all have joint ventures there. They all have very successfully infiltrated the Chinese market. So I think that there's a reluctance there to go down that route. Otherwise, why wouldn't they have done what Tesla has done?
Okay, many of the other Chinese EV makers, of course, SAIC, for example, facing still a 36% tariff. I mean, that sounds pretty brutal, doesn't it? If you're trying to sell a product and it's going to have to be more than a third more expensive, effectively, to get a return. So, I mean, precisely what is going on here? What has changed? Is this a provisional rate? When are these going to be imposed? And is this all still subject to kind of further diplomacy, effectively, between the EU and China?
There's nothing set in stone here, Ed. What happens now is there's a 10-day period during which companies can apply or can appeal against the rate at which they've been given the duty. After that, the EU's member states, the 27 capitals, have to take a vote, and they have to have a majority against these tariffs. So it has to be 15 of 27 member states going against them in order to overturn them. The suspicion is that this will happen and that the tariffs will kick in on Halloween, in the end of October. And you may start to see other companies coming out of the woodwork and applying for separate treatment, as Tesla has done. Maybe they think it's worth their while in doing so. But the procedure is that the member states vote. And in the meantime, there will be some more diplomacy. There's been 10 rounds of technical consultations between the Chinese government and the EU. And don't forget, last week, China launched a case at the WTO related to this. So that will rumble along in the background as well.
Right. So all of the politics is going on. Obviously, the context is the allegation that China is massively giving beneficial treatment to its manufacturers, its car makers and other things. And that's the claim. But aren't Tesla and many Chinese car makers building factories in Europe themselves to boost production, which will allow them to circumvent the tariffs?
Absolutely. And we're going to see more and more of that. And actually, if you look at who was the biggest supporter of the European Commission's investigation, it was the French government. And they've actually been very transparent in what they're trying to do. Mm. Rather cynically, they want to put tariffs on the import of Chinese-made electric vehicles to Europe so that Chinese companies have no choice but to come and build factories in France and other European countries. So the French, the Spanish, the Italians have been fairly transparent about this. Okay. So we will start to see a plethora of these companies building factories in Europe.
Finbar, Birmingham, thank you very much indeed. Now, Ghana's president has formally launched the start of the construction of a multi-billion dollar petroleum hub in the west of the country. Nana Akufo-Addo says that the oil refinery will eventually provide Ghanaians with reliable, affordable, environmentally sustainable energy, something, of course, they've never really had. Despite becoming a major oil producer back in 2010, 90% of the country's refined petroleum still has to be imported from abroad. There are landowners, though, annoyed at the proposed 8,000-hectare site. It's been challenged by the compulsory acquisition of their land. Oliver Barker-Vormawor is a senior partner at the law firm representing some of them.
We are dealing here with over 20,000 acres of land. Many of the persons who have been farming on these lands have owned the land for many generations. And a number of them have woken up to see that the lands have been registered in the names of some chiefs who are backing the government in this project, in disregard of the farmers and individuals who have been farming the lands all this period.
Right. So their traditional rights have been trampled on, they're saying, because the local chief has been bought out.
Yes. And before this project was commissioned, over 100,000 signatures were collected, which was forwarded to the Office of the President in the form of a petition. Environmental activists, farmers, and different people who have mobilized throughout the community to express their displeasure about this project and also about the land grab.
What do your clients want?
So what they're asking for is that they need proper livelihood protection. They want the environmental impact of this project to be really thought through. And also, they're asking for fairness in terms of ownership and those who are being sidelined. But primarily as well, they're asking for some community stake in the project.
And how is the government responding to these claims?
The presidency issued a letter where they are saying they are dealing with one of the chiefs They don't think that the 100,000 signatures collected represents any mandate to deal with that. And so the Big Ten is continuing to mobilize the communities to add pressure.
That's the Ghanaian lawyer Oliver Barker-Vormawor. With me to discuss more of the context here is Bright Siemens. He's a vice president at the Accra-based think tank Imani Africa. Hi, Bright. Remind us of the background, if you will. The idea, I know it's a big idea for Ghana, is to produce its own refined petroleum products, gasoline, diesel, so on.
Indeed, you're right, Ed. So 2018, the government launches this petrol hub. And the idea is to add more value to the country's crude production. Bear in mind, though, that this program, there's a 12-year timeline in which this whole project is supposed to materialize. And so we're already halfway there, and nothing has been built.
Yeah. I mean, okay, it takes a while to build, but what's wrong with the idea? It sounds like a necessary thing. After all, we've been talking for years, haven't we, about Ghana producing added value products, not simply producing raw commodities like cocoa and crude oil.
Indeed. So the general principle is sound, except that the project has been badly designed. So I'll give you an example. It's supposed to build three oil refineries, each of them 300,000 barrels per day capacity. That is more or less, for each refinery, twice, more than twice what the oil Ghana currently produces. So to feed this refinery, you will have to import oil. Secondly, the amount of refined products that each of these refineries is going to produce is roughly three times the amount of consumption in the country. So you have to export a lot. The challenge is that regionally, there have been a bunch of refineries that have come up that are actually struggling to get crude oil to refine, including one in Ghana, or the Central Refinery, that has the capacity to refine up to 200,000 if they could find the crude oil. So we do have refineries available. It's just been more challenging to find the crude oil than it looks, partly because of market distortions and other factors, none of which the government is really, really committed to addressing. So one, that project is not bankable because there's just too much refined capacity than it can actually, you know, the region can actually support. And then secondly, the investors that they found to push this through don't have the money. So we've done due diligence on them. And the main investor has, you know, outpost in the UK and in Switzerland. Outpost in the UK and Luxembourg. The UK entity is dormant. The one in Luxembourg was kicked off the stock exchange. So essentially, we're talking about investors that don't have money. There are some Chinese contractors involved. Right. But these contractors are not bringing finance on.
So what's going on then? I mean, if that's true, presumably the government knows that. Why are they doing this?
We suspect that the real goal is to seize a major stretch of land close enough to the existing oil hub. The existing oil hub in Ghana is in Takra Bay, Sekendi area. And in that part of the country, property prices have really gone up. There's going to be an overflow over time as, you know, the population grows. And this new place, this location for this hub is called Jomoro. Jomoro will in the future, in the near future, become a fairly exciting prospect for real estate speculators. Our view of the matter is that this is really about real estate speculation and not about a petrol hub, because the project itself doesn't make sense.
Okay, well, we're going to have to see. Thank you very much, Bright Siemens.
This podcast is brought to you by Wise, the app that makes using different currencies easy. With Wise, you can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate. There are no hidden fees either. See exactly what you'll pay up front, every time. Join 16 million customers already saving with Wise. To learn how Wise could work for you, download the app or visit wise.com.
I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast. We're in Chicago for a passing of the torch at the Democratic National Convention. Joe Biden has urged Americans to elect Kamala Harris as his replacement. But what will President Biden do with the time he has left in office? And what is the legacy he wants to leave? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Now, joining me is Ayako Yoshioka. She's a Senior Portfolio Manager, Wealth Management Enhancement Group. She's based in Los Angeles. Hi, Ayako. Let's talk about Jackson Hole, shall we? This annual jamboree. Investors are hoping the Federal Reserve is going to signal it's ready to cut rates. What are we hearing there?
Yes, hi, Ed. It is the event of the week, I believe, as things get started in Jackson Hole on Friday. And we are looking to see any sort of commentary about exactly how much they might be willing to be cutting in September. I think they've already commented that they are looking for a cut in September. Not those exact words, but they've hinted to it at the last meeting. And so we're just looking to see how much.
Yeah, I mean, a Reuters poll is talking about a 0.75 rate cut this year alone. That's pretty aggressive, isn't it?
Yes, that would be in line with a 25 basis point cut at each of the next three meetings. And so I think that's mostly the market view, but I think some are still seeing whether or not we might get a 50 basis point cut at one of those meetings, just as the data might unfold a little bit softer than people expect.
Okay, let's talk about Eli Lilly. It's weight loss drug. This is a drug called Zepbound. It's making a bit of a stir, it seems.
Yes, they had great data that showed that it was effective for those who might be predisposed to diabetes. And so it had a 94% effective rate in reducing the chance of getting diabetes. And so the stock was up over 3% on the day. And Lilly's been a strong performer for the year, up 63%.
That is the way to make money, I guess, in the pharmaceutical world. Boeing, not such a happy story. I mean, it doesn't seem... When was the last happy headline for Boeing, I wonder? It seems like it's been some time. Tell us what's happened to them today.
Yes, Boeing continues to have some difficulties. They, you know, halted test flights over a 777 jetliner, just given some issues that they discovered throughout the test flights. And so it's just another issue for Boeing, and the stock was down over 4% on the day. And the stock hasn't done well this year. It's down over 30% for the year.
Okay, thank you very much. That's Ayako Yoshioka, the Senior Portfolio Manager at the Wealth Enhancement Group in Los Angeles. Now then, back in February, there were huge forest fires ripping through the Chilean coastal town of Viña del Mar. They destroyed 90% of the land and plant species in the country's most important botanical garden. It used to be home to hundreds of different plant species, many native to Chile alone. At least 137 people were killed and many homes were destroyed. Now, our reporter, James Chambers, has been back to Viña del Mar as they try to reopen the gardens and get visitors back through the gates.
That's the sound of watering the very green, lush lawns which surround me just walking along a beautiful avenue of trees. And there are plants everywhere, but very sadly, all too close by, you can see the hills where the other trees have just been burnt and the hillside is completely bare, full of ash. We're just passing a little red camper van that sells coffee and other snacks, but it's shut now.
We have quite a few small businesses here. It's summertime, so it is high season for us. There was a canopy for children to play on that was burned, and the main cafe and this camper van. None of them can work, including an old man who used to sell peanuts.
So how many people actually work here? ¿Cuántas personas trabajan aquí?
There are around 60 staff as well as a further 40 support staff, so around 100 employees that have a total salary of around $75,000 per month. Many of them are homeless because the fire destroyed their houses. Although we've been offered a lot of help, it is more in terms of infrastructure rather than help with salaries.
One of those workers is head of the greenhouses and botanical collections, Oscar Fernandez. He tells me it was his birthday on the day of the fire, and he went to the beach for a picnic with his family. He came home to a house that was destroyed. He's currently staying with relatives who are helping him to rebuild his house. Oscar has worked in the garden for the last 20 years and is passionate about looking after his plants. He took me to see the cactus gardens.
Sadly, many of them were burnt or damaged from the heat. And there are also issues with maintenance. A lot of trees fell. The watering system has been damaged. Pipes have been burnt, and that makes it hard for them to survive and for us to do our work. Many of them aren't easy to look after. They require special conditions to cultivate them.
And what will you be able to do to save them?
First of all, we have to have the right mindset, the energy and the will to rebuild this garden. Then we need help with financing the rebuild.
Head of horticulture, Adriana, has a figure in mind and ideas about what it should be used for.
We think that we need around $10 to $20 million to restore the garden. For example, we need to cover this cactus garden, which at the moment is open to the elements. We must protect it from the cold in winter that we get from being near the sea and the hot sun in summer. I have some greenhouses that were damaged by the fire that I would like to rebuild and move closer to the main garden.
The gardens are very different from when I visited just a few weeks after the fires. It's a gloriously sunny winter's day, and you can probably hear all the people. Before the gardens were empty, they were shut. Now they're open. We've got school children, and there are art students I can see in the distance busy sketching various plants. So now I'm off to meet some of the people who've been vital in getting the gardens up and running again. Jorge Torres from a family company called Grupo Hijuelas. He has a personal reason for doing it.
My uncle worked here for 45 years. He worked in the French Gardens, which is one of the places where we're going to use our expertise to help replant and to make it a showcase garden.
Jorge's business specializes in preserving plants that are in danger of extinction and in growing fruit plants and indoor and outdoor plants. I went to meet him in the French garden where his uncle used to work, and he explained his plan.
We want to fill the gardens with different coloured flowers that visitors can enjoy all year round, and that's something you don't normally see in Chilean gardens.
The company works with scientists from around the world and has two high-tech laboratories to ensure that they get the most from their plants.
We take samples from species that managed to survive the fires, and we try to genetically multiply them in our labs so that we can replant the most resistant species around Chile to make sure they thrive. Yes, this is our best known plant. It's the jewel in our crown. So we want to keep the structure of this garden, but have more hydrangeas in different places, and also to introduce more native species. In Chile, it's very normal for people to support each other after fires, floods, and earthquakes. We care about preserving plants, so it was natural for us to want to help. For us, there's no cost, because we get satisfaction from helping.
And that feeling of satisfaction is felt by all the people supporting the botanical garden in Viña del Mar. They know its worth and want to see it thrive again.
Jane Chambers reporting, and you can hear more about the restoration of those botanical gardens at Viña del Mar by searching for Business Daily, wherever you get your BBC podcasts. Now then, to the world of gaming. A snatch there of the online trailer for Black Myth: Wukong. It's a new game made by the Chinese developers based on a classic 16th century Chinese novel called Journey to the West. Picture the scene, if you will. You're a character called the Monkey King, an actual monkey. You're fighting all kinds of mythical beasts and creatures, you know, usual video game stuff. But this newly released game, beautiful graphics for sure, has become one of the most played ever on one of the top player platforms. That may be because it's huge among Chinese players on Weibo and other platforms there available in China. It's not without controversy, though. With me now is Nicole Carpenter. She's a senior reporter at Polygon who's been covering all of this. Hi, Nicole. First of all, describe this game and why it's become so enormously popular so fast.
Right. Well, like you mentioned, it is huge in China. It is one of China's first AAA big budget video games. You know, China is known for its experience in the mobile space, but you don't see these humongous, you know, blockbuster hits. So this game, not only was it made in China, but it is about Chinese mythology. It's basically a retelling of the classic novel Journey to the West.
It's beautifully, beautifully produced. Tens of millions of dollars went into these graphics, right? So it really looks the part. I mean, and it's got you've got a decent journey to go on.
Oh, yeah, it's beautiful. You know, it's a mixture of that sort of adventure spirit, but there's also magic, spells. It's very, it looks gorgeous, and it seems like it plays gorgeous well. I haven't given it a shot yet, though.
So, huge audience, a naturally inbuilt audience with that massive Chinese market, as you say. Tell us about the controversy then. This was talked up in the New York Times, I saw in the last day or so. Reviewers are being told, allegedly, what they can and cannot discuss whilst they're live streaming the game to other gamers. Is that right?
Yes. One important distinction I wanted to make, though, is that the notice about what you can and cannot discuss was sent out to video game streamers, and not all video game streamers. It's not clear how many people this was sent out to, but, you know, people who reviewed the game for outlets like Polygon, which is where I work, or other kind of like journalistic outlets, had to sign an embargo, which, you know, tells you when you can publish your story. It doesn't tell you what you can publish. But this controversy is surrounding a missive sent to some video game streamers. And basically, it was telling them, you know, it's suggesting, highly suggesting, that they shouldn't talk about stuff like feminist propaganda, that's a quote, anything that will instigate negative discourse, not to use trigger words such as quarantine, isolation, COVID-19, and not to talk about China's game industry policies.
Yeah, game industry policies, which of course curtailed the amount that teenagers in China could play. They were really quite restrictive, weren't they, in the last 2 or 3 years? There was a kind of, it felt like a kind of Puritan wave going through the administration there of what was going on with the gaming world. So these are non-enforceable rules, right? I mean, it's not like the streamers in question. These are streamers, by the way, just to be clear, those people who don't know what streamers are, they're people who play the games live online, right, so that other people can watch and appreciate the game and maybe get a taste for it and decide they want to invest.
Exactly. And this notice was given out in exchange for a free key of the game. And it was early access to the game before it came out. Now that the game's out, you know, live streamers can buy their own copy. They don't have to follow these rules. But given the people who did receive these, it's not a legally binding thing. You know, the worst that will happen is that maybe they won't receive a key from this publisher again. They won't have that access anymore ahead of, you know, release.
The wider story here, I suppose, is about China promoting a new kind of global soft power, because, as you say, this is a bit of a first, China entering this realm. It's tried it in movies, not been very successful, but maybe this is a way to reach a wider audience.
Exactly. Yeah, this is a way to bring something that is not only created by a Chinese team, but about Chinese culture. And so, like you said, it's definitely you know, they're inspiring soft power. And I think that is why China and Chinese developers are being restrictive with this sort of missive.
Mm. Nicole Carpenter, senior reporter at Polygon, thank you very much. The game is called Black Myth Wukong. And that's it for this edition of World Business Report. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is brought to you by Wise, the app that makes using different currencies easy. With Wise, you can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate. There are no hidden fees either. See exactly what you'll pay up front, every time. Join 16 million customers already saving with Wise. To learn how Wise could work for you, download the app or visit wise.com.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast, and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.